WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We are taking the Maryland Crab Cake Tour back out on the road. We're coming near you. We're going to be in Carroll County on the 15th, Greenmount Station. It's going to be a good, great Friday for us as we get ready for the weekend, as well as our friends at G&A Coney Island Hot Dog on the 22nd of the month, and then the 27th at Conrad's Crabs in Perry Hall. Looking forward to that. All of these places where Don Moeller taught or did things. Former Baltimore County Executive Don Moeller is our co-host for all these things. And this is one of those ones that's near and dear. It's been a little while since we've had her on, probably about a year. We've been doing this going on 4 years now, you and me. So when we bring people on for the third or fourth time, they come on once a year, and there's always something going on with teachers and unions and students and parents and all those things, as you well know, Don. So I'll let you do the honors on this one.
Well, we're delighted to have back the president of MSEA, state's largest organization representing educators across the state, 76,000 members, Cheryl Boast. And my guess is, Nestor, Cheryl's going to want to know, how come we're Zooming and not having a crab cake? Cheryl would like to be where we're having a crab cake.
Absolutely.
How are you? It's been a little while. How are teachers doing?
I'm great. Our educators, our teachers, our support staff, administrators are our heroes and sheroes, but they're tired. They're tired right now.
Always it's tired. April, Cheryl, man. I got senioritis.
You know, I'm telling you, that's a great, you know, that was, I always say on Baltimore Positive, never a straight line, but they're coming up on spring break as we record this. I remember I used to try to focus on this week with teachers because, as you said, that haul from Christmas to spring break, you're gassed as much as gassed can be. And we always tried to do something fun this week just to get them to the finish line. Is that what you're hearing from your folks across the state?
Oh, absolutely. And spring break is late this year. And for some, it's not even a really long spring break. And put on top of that, everything that's happening with the pandemic. As I met with educators this weekend, they said, we thought last year was bad. This year was even worse. And as you said, it's been a long haul since Christmas break. I think the last day off was President's Day. So it's been a long time for our educators. They're looking forward to spring break. And I've never even heard educators before kind of skip spring break and say, we're ready for June.
Well, Cheryl, I want to go backwards for a minute because we brought you on even before the plague. Then the plague happened and we talked about virtual and all of the chaos. I mean, whether it's kids not having Wi-Fi at home. Don and I sometimes have a hard time doing Zooms because of Wi-Fi. Same thing with one of my employees, Luke. I can't imagine trying to put 30 kids onto a Zoom and all of that. The normalcy of getting back and masked or unmasked wherever we are in various spots at this point. But what did teachers find when they went back into this after the shutdown, through all of this? How have things really changed over 24 months?
It's been a tough change for our students, our families, and our educators. So, you know, we wanted to be back in person, obviously in a healthy and safe way and in an environment. But what we found was our students and even some educators, I think, we weren't acclimated to the classroom in the school. And that took a long time. So you can't just get up and go to the bathroom whenever you want to go to the bathroom. Getting students to put their phones down. Because at home, they've been able to have their phones out. Maybe that was how they even connected virtually. And then what I hear from our educators is when we started school this year, it was, oh, we're back to normal. It's a normal start. Just do like you always have done. And it is not normal in any way, shape, or form. Between some of the academic gaps that we're trying to fill in, a lot of the social emotional needs from our students, our families, and our educators. The trauma is real. And for many of our students, it's just right underneath the skin. So maybe a bump in the hallway was a bump in the hallway before. And now it is just creating such chaos in some of our schools. And we really didn't stop with the demands of our students and our educators to take the time to deal with this social and emotional healing and relationship building again that needs to take place.
Cheryl, we're going to get to recent political developments, but since we've started with focusing on schools and education, which is your mission, let's stay there a minute. You just touched on the social emotional challenges of this year. I hear it every day from educators. You hear it 24/7. One of the issues, and it is not an easy one. If it was an easy one, we would have all solved it. But I hear from parents and community members, kids, teachers, they're all concerned about increasing school violent incidents. And it's not just in one subdivision or another. It's, you get around the state more than anyone. My sense is that it's across the state. It's across the nation. Everyone agrees we can't have violence in our public schools. The question I put to you as the leader of this mammoth organization representing educators, what's the way we need to go about it? Is it a community issue? Is it all hands on deck? What does MSEA say we ought to be doing to make a difference in this area?
Well, you're right that it is across the state, and it's pre-K to 12th grade. It's across this nation, as I talk to other state presidents. But our educators have been saying for a long time some of the ways that we can address this. We do not have enough school counselors, school psychologists, or school social workers to help with the number of students in our schools. There are industry standards of 1 to 250 for, I believe, our school counselors. Some of our school counselors have student caseloads of 1,000, 1,200. And so they
can't. Cheryl, I'm going to stop you just for a second, and I apologize. Okay. I would suggest if you're a district that's funding a counselor at 1 to 1,000, save the money and put it someplace else, because 1 to 1,000 is going to get you no net positive effect at all. And obviously, I don't mean cut it out. Obviously, I'm going to support where you're going. But if you're funding 1 to 1,000, stop pretending you're making a difference. That's my rant. Go ahead.
Absolutely. And so put on top of that the additional trauma. So we probably need more than we needed before.
What's the number? What's the right number there? 1 to what? You guys are the experts on this.
I have to look at the industry standards. I think it's 1 to 250 for our school counselors and 1 to 500 for our school psychologists. I believe. I'd have to go back and look at.
Don, you did that job. How many kids can you meet with in a week? If you're taking on a regular child who's had trauma, had an issue, needs to have counseling in the school, 45-minute session. How does that work?
I did have that job. Cared deeply about school counseling. Cheryl may be right at 250. My gut was always one to three fifty. I always thought you could make a difference. And what that means, Nestor, is the outstanding counselors, and Cheryl and I know a bunch of outstanding counselors, they do a variety. They schedule children one-on-one. They schedule.
I was one of those kids, by the way. You were my sort of quasi guidance counselor, but in middle school, because my father tried to steal me and run off to Venezuela, all the stuff that I probably don't talk about a lot. But I had adopted parents who had a dead child in 1960. Like, you know, all of this. I had a guidance counselor. Her name was Evelyn Stopek. She was the most wonderful lady. I Googled her recently to see that we lost her maybe a decade ago. But I remember going and playing tennis with her. I love tennis. And she took me out on the courts at Holabird Middle in 1980, 81, 82, when I had some trauma in my life and an alcoholic mother, all that stuff. It's taken me 40. I haven't never told you that, maybe. I don't know. But like 40 years later, I wonder what happens when, I mean, I was in a weird situation, but certainly I turned out okay. But I can't imagine children with real problems and how much they need an Evelyn Stopek or a Don Moeller in their life. You know,
I think Cheryl would tell you that there are a lot of little Nestor and Nestorinas running around out there. You do it through groups. You do it through that. You do it through classroom visits. You can never forget the crisis intervention part. And again, we all have firsthand accounts. I mean, Cheryl could fill a book with firsthand accounts. I can think personally my grandchildren, and how fond, particularly right now, one of my grandsons is of his counselor in elementary school, just has a wonderful relationship. They're game changers, right, Cheryl?
Absolutely. They're game changers. And they're needed for students, as you were saying, Nestor, who have, you know, major problems or just to de-escalate something that day and at that time. But also critical to that are all the other staff in the building. And as a teacher, as a fourth grade teacher, about this time of year, I better be getting to multiplication with two digit numbers based on my math curriculum. Well, I'm working with students who are at an academic deficit right now. I mean, let's face it, it's a historic pandemic. We have to get out of it. I don't have the time as a teacher to now sit and have a group conversation with my students because somebody else is saying, you have to get to this curriculum on this day. Because guess what? It's happening in April. Standardized tests are happening. And our school is going to be rated on a scale of 1 to 5 on how well we're doing on our academics. And, you know, not even caring that we were in a pandemic, that our students have needs, our families have needs. 144,000 children across this country have lost a caregiver to the pandemic. And we are not paying any attention to that with the services, the counselors, or allowing educators to take the time to build those relationships. If I'm a fourth grade teacher, Nestor, and I see that you're irritated today, I want to be able to get to know you a little bit to know, hey, he's irritated. Here's are those tells that he's showing me today. But if I have to just keep going through and put on top of that, class sizes have increased because we're in the Great Resignation. We have such a huge educator shortage right now that they're doubling up classes. They're asking teachers to teach during their planning time. They're asking school secretaries, counselors to cover classes. So the services that we want to provide are even stretched thinner now because of the shortages.
Cheryl, we have these are such compelling issues. We have a national teacher crisis in terms of attracting educators to these fields. I mean, so many of the helping professions, whether it's police officers, teachers, social, they have a shortage. Other than we know that increasing salaries will make a difference. Other than increasing salaries, what do we need to do to make the profession more attractive so that we don't have these shortages year after year?
The first thing is respect. We've seen the highest level in my career of disrespect towards educators and towards public schools. We have to, as a community, as a society, turn that around and respect our educators and the profession that we're in. But we have to reduce the workload, whether it's a paperwork for evaluations, paperwork for special education students. Paperwork is not going to make our students succeed academically or help their social emotional learning. So we have to take some of these things off the plate. Every time we add something, whether it's a law that comes out of Annapolis or a county or a directive, we're not taking it off. And Dawn, we are facing this shortage across the country. And I believe the biggest problem that we have is retention. We know the pipeline is dry, and we know that it's going to take a while to fill that pipeline. But if we don't do something now between pay, benefits, workload, and respect to keep the people that are here, then we are going to have a continuous churn of people that are just going out. My colleagues who are hitting year 30, they used to say, oh, I'm going to be in here for another 5 years, 6 years. I'm just kind of, you know, getting towards retirement, but not thinking about it. I have more and more friends who are at the 30-year mark, and they're like, I'm out.
They're tired. Sure, I want to push you a little bit and not argue about it, but try to gain clarity. And that is one of my frustrations over the years when I would talk with you and others, and both in TABCO and MSEA and teachers at the schoolhouse, I would hear this issue of if we could just reduce paperwork. But it seemed to me that we were never able to be specific as to what we meant by that. It sounds good, and I'm not suggesting it's not genuine, but I was never able to quite understand what that meant. Can you put a clearer face on it?
Sure. I'm going to pick one area because I agree with you. It can be very ambiguous. We have to drill down and say to a pre-K teacher, what does workload relief look like? Or to a fourth grade teacher. I'm just going to right now focus on our special education teachers. Everybody knows, and Dawn, through your time, that they have the highest workload paperwork than ever. What we're seeing in many of our districts is there are state and federal requirements for IEPs for students with special needs.
What's IEP?
Now, I'm sorry. Thank you, Nestor. An individualized education program.
That's why I sit here. I'm the idiot in the corner that raises my hand.
So with a student who has learning needs, they need specialized instruction. And so that individualized education program writes out the goals for that individual student. And then teachers know what supports and acceleration that student needs. But not only do we have state and federal requirements, but districts then lay on top of that their own requirements and paperwork. So now I'm doing it for three levels of bureaucracy. And what I hear from our special education teachers are like, can we just pick one of these that we're doing and not, oh, well, the Baltimore County or Montgomery County or somebody, they want this paper, the state wants this paper, and the federal wants this paper, and they say the exact same thing.
So coordination among the government regulators to say, let's not ask these folks to fill these things out in triplicate.
Absolutely.
Well, that's concrete. I mean, that's now, sure, let's shift that for a minute because there's so much talk, you and I talk offline about the blueprint for Maryland progress. Is that the kind of, I guess there's a small question here and a 10,000 foot question. Is that the kind of specific recommendation and action that could come out of the blueprint along with the funding? Which is one question. And then the other question is, everybody has a lot resting on this, the success of this blueprint. Certainly MSAEA, which fought like crazy for its passage. You all want to make sure it works. So how do you do that? Go back to my first question. Are the kind of recommendations about coordination, could that be part of it? And second, how are you going to make sure from day one that this thing is working and not a boondoggle?
Right. So the blueprint was a historic investment, as you know, in public education. Unfortunately, under Governor Hogan, he's already set us back a little over a year. He vetoed it, so we had to override the veto, but the deadlines remained the same within the blueprint. So we're a little bit behind there. He delayed in the implementation of the Accountability Implementation Board. And just this year, his first budget was taking money out of the blueprint, and then he wanted to be hailed as a hero when he put the money he took out back in. But we wanted to be successful. I'm not sure exactly if the blueprint is going to drill down to that level, but here's where I think it can help. One of the implementation points of the blueprint are community schools. To turn areas of concentrated poverty, schools that serve as concentrated poverty, to give them the funding to become a community school. And a community school puts in place a coordinator, and they do a needs assessment of the educators, the parents, and the community of what they want to see in their school. So if educators say, hey, all this duplicate workload is interfering with me from teaching the students that are in front of me, we're hoping that that can come out in that process. What it also does is it brings in some of what we were talking about earlier, those support services. It can bring in some of the mental health supports, some of the wellness supports that are needed in these areas. So if we take each item within the blueprint and drill down and say, how can we make sure that it is implemented successfully? I think it can. And, you know, tutoring is a huge part of the blueprint, especially in our primary grades. So if I have a tutor as a second grade teacher, that they can help remediate some of my students who are falling behind, that does take some of the workload from me as the educator. So I think I have found, and you know, Dawn, where I worked at Mars Estates Elementary School, when the system came in and said to the educators there, what do you need to be successful? And we talked to the parents and the community, we turned that school around. They didn't say, well, this is what we saw Riverview needed, so we're just going to do the same thing to you at Mars Estates. They said, no, what do you specifically need? And we believe that that can come out through the blueprint because it's providing additional funding, and schools that need it and need something a little different can get it. But we just make sure, we have to make sure that educators' voices are at the table during this implementation.
Hey, Don, is that equal or equitable? Which one is that?
Good question, Nestor.
Right. It's everybody getting what they need. Making it equitable or fair for Mars Estates is different than what's going to look like in Riverview. It's going to look like different where I taught at Pretty Boy. It's going to look different based on the needs of our students.
Carol, I think of that every single day. I have anybody who follows me on Facebook knows that I have 6-year-old twin grandchildren, Declan and little Miss Amy that we call the princess. And I think as I watch them, because of the outstanding education they've received at Hillcrest Elementary and community support and family support, both of them are going to arrive in first grade as readers. Now, I was an area superintendent in other parts of the county where children would often come not able to recognize their letters. So, as you say, it's not equal to Nestor. Nestor asks the $64,000 question. School X doesn't necessarily need what school Y needs, right, Cheryl?
Absolutely. Well, you see with your own children and your grandchildren how different they are, just within their own, in your own family, and they have different needs. And so when you amplify that to an entire school, with my students at Mars Estates, this might have been their 10th or 12th school that they're hitting by fourth grade.
Oh, right. Wow. Our time is short. I want to get to election season because you all are major players in that. But before we do, how will you judge the blueprint? Because Nestor and I have had a bunch of them on. The critics would say, we're going to look back after 10 years. It's going to be the same old, and we will have flushed this money down the toilet. How will you be looking? What will success look like to you?
Success will appear when our community schools are actually functioning as community schools and not a one size fits all. They all look the same. And educators and students have a voice. When we expand pre-K, are we really expanding it? Did the money get to the district and actually to the school so that we're helping expansion of pre-K? Are more of our students enrolled in dual enrollment? Are they enrolled in career technology education, not just in the college path? So we have to look at the outcomes. But here's what has happened too long, and our critics keep saying, we need outcomes, we need outcomes. How about this? Pay attention to what you're putting into it. You know, we keep getting told what we have to do and sometimes what we can't do, but nobody talks about the needs in between to get there. And that's where the blueprint is different. The blueprint
I want to be clear on that, though, Cheryl. You're not suggesting that a component of the evaluation shouldn't be outcomes, right? I mean, shouldn't increased student achievement be important to the success of the blueprint?
Increased student achievement is, I don't think that right now in this state or in this country, we measure student achievement appropriately. That's probably for a whole nother show. But I do believe student achievement has to be part of it. But we can't just say, what's the outcome? This blueprint is putting that money in so that we can get to a better outcome.
Okay, fair enough.
Cheryl Bost is our guest. She is MSEA president and always talking about teachers and unions. And the news came out this week. And, you know, Don's very political. I am very observant. And Don jumps in on candidates. You're an endorser. You're an old school political guy. So for him to talk about Westmore.
I don't know about old school. Just old.
I don't give money to political candidates. I give them airtime and ask questions, and sometimes hard questions. I have endorsed one person in the history of this show, literally one. Well, I'm about to endorse my second, but I'll get into that. And hi, Heather. But nonetheless, for Westmore and for what the Teachers Association and teachers around the state need, you've already kicked Hogan in the shins. I'll kick him again in the shins because I'm from Baltimore. We've sat next to him. Don gets along better with him than apparently I did, or doesn't get along better, but agrees with him more than I do. In this particular case, what would Westmore mean and what would a different governor mean? And obviously not vetoing things like Kerwin, right? But what? Where's Wes in all of this and what makes him attractive to teachers?
Well, let's get to all that, Nestor, and let's ask Cheryl to start with statewide candidates. You endorsed 376,000 members. Who did you all come out and endorse this weekend? Because folks may not know.
Right. Well, so we have a very democratic, we always say small D process, where we have an endorsement council, our delegates, and we do a lot of interviewing, questionnaires, everything. And we open it up to all running can take part in our process. But this weekend at our spring representative assembly, we endorsed Westmore for governor, Brooke Learman for comptroller, and Anthony Brown for attorney general, after looking at all the other candidates who sought our endorsement. And I can tell you specifically for Westmore, we saw in Wes a commitment to public education, a commitment to making sure that educators have a voice at the table, and energy that we think is needed to energize the electorate to come out and vote. We see so many voters that sit home, but when we really look, so many people felt that energy and the relational experience that our leaders had with Wes. He took the time to talk, share his points of view and where he is on anything from charters to boost to our ESP, our education support professional wages that are needed in this state. It's a very lengthy questionnaire where we ask a lot of questions. And Brooke, again, and Anthony also education focused on what they're looking at in their platforms and really had an understanding of what their jobs can do to help with public education in the state.
Sure. One of the things that folks have said to me across the state when evaluating different candidates is, and I think you touched on it, maybe you can revisit it and talk about why it was impactful with your teachers. One of the things they will say about Wes is that not all candidates are always good listeners, and that what I sensed in Wes Moore was someone who is a good listener and will be a good listener. Was that part of the equation as your delegates began to vote?
Absolutely. As some of our leaders throughout this state said, when they met with Wes or had a phone call with him, he took the time to find out who they were, what they do, and their needs. Where they said other candidates sat down and immediately started telling their platform and what they're going to do, what they're not going to do. Wes has a way to get to know people. And the other thing that I know our folks appreciated, he then articulated those items in his education platform that he's posted. He articulated those same instances. He learned from listening instead of just kind of checking the box and talking to our folks. And you could see that. And as educators, we know active listening and it comes out through one's actions. And folks were really impressed with that part of it and his advocacy that we see that he will bring to the table.
So tell folks, as we wrap it up, tell folks, I mean, they look at the number and it's a huge number, 76,000 members, and your organization endorses statewide candidates. You have a remarkable win record. I saw somewhere, I think in primary elections, it's 85% of the candidates endorsed by MSEA win. Nestor, you will have a new experience now when you go to vote in the county. There will be folks out there with what we call the Apple ballot. It's one of the few ballots that people actually reach and grab and say, hey, I want the Apple ballot. I want because education matters to everyone. What does your organization do starting now to help the candidates that you've endorsed be elected?
Well, absolutely. We already started that Saturday evening with our digital ads and digital displays and everything that we're going to do. But we are a lot of boots on the ground. So our 76,000 educators will be at polling sites handing out the Apple ballot. We're also talking to our neighbors and still within this state, even though we don't always see the respect, it shows that educators are respected individuals in the state. We do a lot of vetting, whether it's the Board of Education candidates that are on that Apple ballot, the county council, county executive, or even congressional and statewide. We do a lot of vetting, a lot of interviewing, and it's done by members. It's not done by me. It's not done only by local presidents. It is done by committees of members who actually
imagine the arguments going on in that room. You know, when you come out, to, you know, when the smoke comes out and they say O'Malley or Brown, you know,
a little excited. Hey, Nestor, should we wrap up by asking Cheryl if the Pittsburgh Steelers are really going to start Mitchell Trubisky at quarterback?
Cheryl, you'll be happy to know that as I do each and every year to show that I'm non-denominational, I actually get along with the Steelers people better than I get along with some of the Ravens people at this point. But Mike Tomlin and I get together every year. So I'll have you know that he's still doing well and wonderful, and we still laugh about all of my favorite quote, and we had a really good laugh about this, was about the we want volunteers around here, not hostages. I feel that's my favorite of all. He cut a football play, traded a player on a trading deadline, and said, "We want volunteers, not hostages."
I love Mike Tomlin. I love my Steelers. It's going to be a transition year as to who's going to be our.
I love to hear that. I love a transition year.
Listen to you.
Transition year.
But they've had a lot of those in Cleveland.
Wait a minute, she said there's a but, Nestor.
But I don't think you all have a quarterback signed just yet, and. I was so happy to hear that Brady was going back to play, because now my Ben Roethlisberger will have his day to himself in the Hall of Fame.
There you go. There you go.
I don't know if that's first ballot. You might.
First ballot.
I know the guys that vote. I bet he's not. You want to bet some Pizza John's on that? Let's go.
Oh, there we go.
Is it Pizza John's versus Permane Brothers, or what is that?
Mine's better.
Oh, I love Pizza John's. I was just there.
Hey, it's good to have you on, as always, yins and not. And we're all in the same boat with the Pirates and the Orioles, so there's no, you know, there's no back and forth on that at all. So at least
Cheryl, do you put French fries on your subs?
I put French fries on my salads. I put potato chips on my subs. Yes, French fries go on everything.
Nestor, what can we say?
Weird. Y'all are weird. That's all I'm saying. On behalf of former Baltimore County Executive Don Mohler, MMSEA President, she's a teacher, fourth grade teacher. She's Cheryl Boast. Always good to have her on, and always good to be talking with teachers and educators and all of these important, wise conversations that we have around here. The Maryland Crab Cake Tour, presented by the Maryland Lottery, and our friends at Goodwill Industries, is going to be getting back out on the road. Looking forward to that. Looking forward to baseball season, amongst other things. I am Nestor. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. We never stop talking crab cakes, teachers, kids, and Baltimore Positive.